Hey there, skips and skipperettes from all across the wild and untamed electronic wasteland known only as Internet Land. Welcome back to Tales from the Jungle Cruise. Or what I should say, probably, is welcome to Tales from the Jungle Cruise. You see, this is a special introduction recorded just for all the new listeners that we've magically have gained because of some generous promotion by the guys over there at the Nerdist podcast. They were cool enough to mention us on their podcast, which gets like 2.5 jillion listeners per episode, and so it looks like a bunch of you are swinging over this way to see what we're all about. So I thought I'd pick one of our best episodes and record a little intro to welcome you on board. Now, I was born a Jungle Cruise skipper. Well, that's not entirely true, otherwise I would have been making jokes about the backside of uterus, but I've always been a big fan of the ride. Now, in 2001, I left a big corporate job, got a divorce, bought a convertible, and went to work at Disney's California Adventure. Not long after that, I went over to Disneyland and started my many years at the Jungle Cruise. Now, I was just a wisecracking skipper who didn't play by the rules, and my boss knew it. I was just one day away from retirement when... All right, anyway, that's Lethal Weapon or something. But a couple of years after I left Disneyland, the whole podcast boom had started, and about 4 years ago, the Tales from the Jungle Cruise podcast was born. Now, at first, it was just me interviewing my friends, and I really had no clue about things like audio quality or editing, so the first episodes are a little rough. Now, eventually, I started interviewing people from 20, 30, 40 years ago at Disneyland, and I think the podcast has come into its own with a little polish and a much better personality. We also have these fun little radio plays that delve into the fictional world of Jungle Cruise skippers, and we're actually, this is a totally new announcement, we're in the playtesting stages of a board game called Rivers of Adventure, which has nothing to do with Disney or the Jungle Cruise. For legal reasons, but that's going to come out sometime this summer, and we're having a lot of fun with it. Mostly, at the end of it, you know, I just love Disney and Disneyland. Even with my blunt commentary sometimes about its flaws and all the things I notice, at the root of what I'm doing is a basic realization that even with all of its flaws, it's still the happiest place on Earth. Working there changed me, and I want to share the experience of being a Disney cast member through these oral histories with you. We have a lot of fun going back down the memory lane of the jungle, and I hope you do too. If, by the way, you are a skipper, know a skipper, or just want to send us a comment, our email is junglecruise, C-R-E-W-S, @gmail.com. Over on Twitter, we're @skipcast, and on Facebook, facebook.com/junglecruise, C-R-E-W-S. Now, here's a fairly recent episode with skipper Don Bobbs. Don worked at Disney starting in 1964. This is a favorite episode of mine, and this guy is just a treasure trove of Disney knowledge that I couldn't have even imagined when I started talking to him. Now, if you're looking for other good episodes to start with, we also have a tab on our podcast page called Start Here, and our podcast page is at Jungle Cruise, C-R-E-W-S, @podbean.com. Thanks, everyone. Welcome aboard, and Kungaloosh. Hey there, skips and skipperettes from all across the vast electronic wasteland known only as Internet Land, and welcome back to Tales from the Jungle Cruise. So today is the second interview in a series where we begin our new tradition of interviewing only people named Don. We started with Don Chapman, and today we are interviewing another long-legacied skipper, Skipper Don Bobbs. So if you are also named Don, well, maybe we can interview you as well. Although I doubt Donald Duck will ever make an appearance. You know, all Don joking around, this is the first of a two-part interview with a really distinctive figure from the jungle past. From 1968 to 1985, Don worked all around the park, but mainly at our dearly beloved Jungle Cruise. Don and I chat about his first time visiting the park with his family in 1955. That's right, the first year the park was open. We chat about the very early days of Disneyland, and Don is definitely, so far, the skipper we have gotten to chat with who was working at the park the earliest. To put that in perspective, Don started working at Disneyland 46 years ago and left 29 years ago. When you've been around a place that long, you have some amazing stories, and those are made even more amazing by Don's genuine love and enthusiasm for Disney, Disneyland, and the magic that has been being made there for nearly 60 years. You know, look, I love doing this podcast. You know, we may not have the largest listenership, but we're growing. It does take a lot of energy and time for me, as well as a good chunk of cash every year. So every once in a while, I kind of evaluate what I'm doing and if I keep wanting to do it. And I got to admit, before Labor Day, I was kind of in a slump. It's a time of year, it's hard to get interviews. Our listenership slows down with all the school starting. And coming out of this interview, well, it's the kind of experience that reinvigorates and brings back the love of what I'm doing. Getting to chat with skippers like Dawn, it definitely lights the fire under me and helps me feel like what I'm doing is worthwhile. So if you think that what we're doing is worthwhile and want to keep hearing stories like this, we only ask you to do two very simple things. The most important is to share us with your friends and other people who love Disney. We're over at Facebook at facebook.com/junglecruise, C-R-E-W-S. And also, we haven't had any new iTunes reviews in over a year. Now, we know you guys listen and that we've had a lot of new listeners. If you could give us a nice little comment, we'd appreciate it. We're also over at Stitcher Radio if you prefer them on Android or iPhone. All right, my friends, it's an episode 60 years in the making. I present to you Skipper Don Bobbs, Season 4, Episode 4, in a show we call The Friend of Disneyland. Kungaloosh, everyone. Which is a scale that I never anticipated that people would be interested in.
Yes, I see. And so they're not all ex-Jungle Cruisers.
Oh, no, gosh, no. I think that I think it's probably about 40%, 50% are ex-cast members.
Mm-hmm.
But we have people listening from Canada, Germany, Russia. We've got someone in Russia who subscribes because I see all the downloads going.
Yes, yes, I see.
So, yeah, so it's interesting. Japan, Australia, one that I thought was strange was Ecuador. We have someone who from Ecuador who downloaded all of the episodes. So it's funny that, you know, what we did in the time, whether it be 15 years ago for me now or whether, you know,
more than 29 for me.
Yeah, that people still have not only an interest at Disneyland, but specifically what these stories are things that they haven't heard. Whether they know people who are being interviewed or whether they're just fans of it, it gives them an insight.
Yeah,
into things
certainly.
That are different. And the Jungle Cruise particularly it's an exceptional encapsulation of what the park is about. It's of the 10 rides that
I would agree.
Are open today that were open in 1955.
Only
10.
I see.
Do you know what all 10 of them were?
Well, I can guess. Peter Pan, Mr. Toad, Snow White.
Snow White, actually.
I'm positive.
It was? Okay, so Snow White.
Dumbo. Teacups. Carousel.
Doing pretty well.
Mark Twain.
Jungle Cruise, Mark Twain.
Okay, I've gotten to 8, so there are two more.
Although it's a little tricky because they consider Main Street vehicles to be an attraction. So So that's one of them.
And is it going to be basically, is the last one?
The last one.
Would it be a ride or is it just something people would not consider?
Well, no. It's something people would consider.
Okay.
It's a big one. It's from the viewpoint of, it was very important to Walt. That was a good clue. It kind of encapsulates all of Disneyland.
Now, some were not running on opening day.
Yeah.
Oh, of course, the steam trains.
Steam trains, yeah.
Right, and but Casey Jr. opened within the first week, so that would be another one.
I think Casey Jr. they did during the 50th consider that one of the opening day.
Right, because I think it was ready to go, but it had glitches.
Yeah.
There probably are others like that where it wasn't quite ready to go. Like, I don't know, rocket jets or...
Yeah. When was the first time you went to the park as a guest?
It would have been in the first year, but certainly not the first day.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't. Crazy day.
Well, we went pretty frequently. But
Oh, yeah. But this is the kind of thing. I mean, we'll get
sure.
To, we'll, I mean, this is.
Sure.
I like it to be just very conversational. So I, you know, we'll.
No, I understand.
We'll get point by point. But this, but this is interesting, you know, because you were there in that early time as a guest.
Oh, not only that, but we were such big, big fans. Mm-hmm. But maybe I'll stick to my agenda because I think I've thought it through pretty.
Sure.
I spent a lot of time. I wanted to contact. I did contact some of my old friends, read the old Jungle Drums and things. Mm-hmm. And in my research for this interview, I discovered the answer to a little mystery. Mm-hmm. That I had wondered about for decades.
Okay.
It was that Brazilian pepper tree. Mm-hmm. Out in front of the entrance. You
yep.
know what I'm talking
oh, yeah,
about.
Absolutely.
Hollow. But it had a latched or a hinged door over the... Mm-hmm. It was very nicely made.
Yep.
And... I didn't find out about it till a friend of mine reached down into it and pulled out his lunch. And he said, even though guests could easily do the same thing, he says, nobody would suspect because it's so beautifully mm-hmm. designed and made that you wouldn't think of opening up and down deep in the hollow part of the limb. Well, you probably know it. Mm-hmm. I had the book all along, 25 cents probably from about 1954, The Little Man of Disneyland, a golden book.
Yep.
About a leprechaun, and he was displaced by the construction of building Disneyland. And it was, I think I haven't found my book. It's in the house somewhere.
Sure.
But it ends with some line, like in Boys and Girls, when you're at Disneyland, search and search until you find the little house that Walt Disney or the we had built for the little man because he lives there now.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that was the reason for making that the hinged mm-hmm. Door, and it looked very natural and very good. I'm pretty sure the tree isn't there anymore.
You know, and it's interesting because that's it points out something about the way that guests interact with Disneyland. Is even things that you would think natural curiosity would have you poke your head into to things or. You know, that people kind of respect the magic of it a little bit. People
it was
don't.
Very nicely done, so it
yeah.
looked so natural.
Yeah.
The only thing that was odd was why it would be hinged, because you could see them plugging it,
mm-hmm.
but not making it into a compartment. That was mysterious.
Yeah.
So that was pretty neat. Now, I started in 1968,
mm-hmm.
but fall of 69 was when I switched to Jungle Cruise.
Sure. Where
I wanted to. Well, first I had worked as a costume character,
mm-hmm.
and I had worked at least one day in Adventureland as King Louis the Ape,
mm-hmm.
right by the exit of Jungle Cruise. And I know the movie was really new then because
yeah.
it had come out the previous year, and it was really popular, Jungle Book,
mm-hmm.
and children. Costly coming up, because it was before home video, but they'd say, King Louis, jump rope through your arms like you did in the movie.
Yeah.
Well, I could barely walk, let alone in that heavy, cumbersome thing. But it was pretty cute. We had a Baloo the bear there with me,
mm-hmm.
and they actually had King Hottie, the big elephant,
mm-hmm.
operated by two people. And I think once in a while the Disneyland band would come through and they'd play that, ba-da-dum-bum-bum, the King Hottie, I mean, Colonel Hottie March.
Yep.
And I think we'd have a tiny parade. I only did that one day.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the time I played a Mary Poppins' friend, Bert, the mm-hmm. chimney sweep.
Oh, absolutely.
But this was back in the days when I was kind of a messy chimney sweep. I had a broom mm-hmm. smudged black on my face.
Sure.
And I'd say, shake hands for good luck.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember one day... you know, people didn't, because that's in the song, Jim mm-hmm. Jim Cherie.
Yeah, absolutely.
A little boy came up and says, I'll shake your hand. He had an electric buzzer.
One of the little wind-up ones?
Yes. And during the year I was a character, sometimes at night,
mm-hmm.
They'd assign about four of us to catch Tinkerbell, the aerialist who would fly from mm-hmm. the Matterhorn.
Yep.
And there was a berm, part of the old... mine train ride behind, say, the Fantasyland Theater where the Pinocchio ride
yep, absolutely.
Would be now. And it was grassy hill. And she'd come flying in.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe she had a handset for brakes.
Mm-hmm.
But still, she was coming in pretty fast. And so we held up a big oversized mattress, mm-hmm. and she'd slam into the mattress, knock it down onto the grassy hill, and that was it.
So one of the things we put up some pictures. I try to do interesting, like, things on the Facebook page. One of the things I found was these pictures of all the costume characters from 50s, 60s, 70s, and how that evolved. I mean, just going from the 60s on, it mm-hmm. was such a change in how much better they looked. I mean, did you...
They certainly did.
When you were doing it.
The first ones, you know, were, I think, from the Ice Capades, and they looked really... they were terrible.
Yeah, and they definitely weren't good for being close up.
No, they weren't good by the time I did it either. Mm-hmm. For the most part, they had people about my height was pretty standard. Mm-hmm. I'm 5'7", and we would play miniature characters because the head of the character was down, mm-hmm. say, around below our chest, say the tummy area,
yeah.
and there'd be a big hat or honey pot or the Mad Hatter's hat. They would go up over our face.
Mm-hmm.
So they were very cumbersome. There wasn't much we could do except walk.
And sometimes I bet that was challenging.
It certainly was, yeah. because you couldn't, the vision wasn't very good, and you couldn't see children around you, so you would accidentally bump into children.
Now, did they have other people working with you at the time? Because I know that now, not a single costume character goes out without a person out of costume to escort them.
We did have that.
You did have some, they call them tail patrol now. But
I see. I think they were... I'd have to think what we call them. They were usually former characters. Mm-hmm. They'd usually wear, I guess, shirt and tie.
Yep.
And they would just kind of stand around. I think they might be watching over a few sets, or mm-hmm. we call them units. So the three pigs
yeah.
and the seven dwarfs might only have one lead. It was, I didn't actually plan to talk about being a character at all.
Oh, no.
It was funny. Because we were so limited in what we could do.
Mm-hmm.
And generally, we would just rest our hands into the nose of the character, and about the most you could do is wiggle the nose. And the funniest one was Grumpy.
Mm-hmm.
He had a big, let's say, basketball-size nose.
Mm-hmm.
And you could grab onto the nose and pull it in till it would suck into the face, and children would go, Grumpy, what? And then you could, boom, pop it out. And it didn't hurt them at all.
Yeah.
But it was kind of a funny gag. But some of the children were mean, and they'd try to push us over.
We didn't have
use of our hands.
Yeah, I heard with villains in particular that was a big issue with the Big Bad Wolf or any of the villains, they would get more of the brunt of the...
I don't think I ever played a villain, yeah. but I did play the practical pig. From the three pigs,
yeah.
he was designed to have a permanent scowl on his face. And I remember I'd hear all day long, "It's the mean pig, get him!"
I think Honest John, is that Honest from Pinocchio?
That's right. Yeah,
he was the one that
Worthington Foulfellow.
Yeah, was one that with this helicopter go.
Right, right.
So, yeah, he was one. So so how long? Sorry, let me just wait for the helicopter. I'll slice that.
I worked in characters for a full summer, including a big... I did some special events that were intriguing. One would have been the world premiere at the Disney studio mm-hmm. of Winnie the Pooh and the Blustery Day.
Yep.
And the animators came and brought their families along with movie stars and celebrities. So mm-hmm. I was there as a character to greet people as they came in. But a better event, I was a chimney sweep along with Mary Poppins, the Hollywood Bowl Disney Family Night.
Mm-hmm.
And so I performed at the Hollywood Bowl.
That's great.
Doing routines along with Mary Poppins. Mm-hmm.
I love Mary Poppins. The movie came out last mm-hmm. year, The Saving Mr. Banks, and I have had very strong feelings about
I her. Certainly do have my complaints.
I felt like it was revisionist history. Let's just leave
mm-hmm.
it at that.
Mm-hmm.
I it was not an accurate representation of certain things. But it's one of those things that I find really endearing is that movie has held up so beautifully for 50 years.
It certainly has. I was friends with the Dick Van Dyke family
mm-hmm.
through church, and so I had a lot of insight. And I remember one time we went exploring at the studio, and there were the carousel horses from the Jolly Holiday
yeah,
sequence stashed in an old shed, I think in the Zorro or their western town,
mm-hmm.
rotting. The paint, it was only a few years later, but obviously the elements had, they were falling apart. Yeah. Nobody taking care of it. I'm sure I have many, many. The Sherman brothers were longtime family friends. Their family going back maybe to the 1930s with my family. And they encouraged my parents to move out to California. Mm-hmm. So I have lots of stories about them. And they wrote me my introductory letter to help me get a job at the park.
That's excellent.
I still have the letter. Happiest Millionaire Stationery.
I love that movie. You know, it's funny, when I was...
I can tell you for hours about Happiest Millionaire, and when the Sherman Brothers came at the Disney Studio, we had a celebration when the print was restored and put back together. And the Biddle Bible class, we had special sweatshirts made up by Stacia Martin to... I can remember every word the Sherman Brothers said at the talk afterwards.
There was a...
But I'm getting so far away from Jungle Cruise.
This is all part of the... Mm-hmm. This is the gestalt. This is all of the things that led you into that. I got really lucky. I'm just telling this, that story you'll be interested in. I was down from living in Washington, and me and my ex at the time were just walking. It was a rainy day.
Yes, and of course.
It was one of those days where there might have been 10,000 people in the park. Almost no one was there. And we're walking by the Golden Horseshoe, and this lady with a clipboard says, "Hey, we need to fill some seats out for a taping. Will you guys come in?" And we're like, "Of course, it's raining. We don't want to be out here." So we went in, and we sit down, and there's TV camera, recording film cameras, and they introduce it, and it was the Sherman Brothers came out for 2 hours. They were interviewed, I want to say it was Tom Lehrer, but I know it wasn't. Mm-hmm. But a great interviewer was there, but they played, you know, songs, did the whole thing and told the stories. And I really want at some point to find that video or movie of that
event. I'm sure it exists.
It was such a beautifully well put
I know
together.
Where it might be available. This is just a guess. But University of, like Disney University in Florida had a big collection, this in the days of videotape, where employees could check out from their library of that type of thing. And you might be able to find it there.
And when I had met Dave Smith, the archivist, it was one of the things I forgot to ask him.
I know Dave Smith very well.
So let's go back to that. So you were working as King Louie outside the Jungle Cruise.
For one day.
For one day. Did the bug cross over? Was that what the jungle water got into your veins? Or
probably. You know, I don't think I went on the Jungle Cruise when I was very young. Disneyland opened in 1955. I probably thought it would be too scary. And I think the first year or so, they didn't have ticket books. I don't believe so, or coupon books. Mm-hmm. I think you had to pay extra for each ride. And so I'm pretty sure that my family only paid the general admission and went on no rides.
Yeah.
It probably took a few years till I ever went on the Jungle Cruise.
Yeah.
And I think in the early days of coupon books, it might have only gone up to C. That's kind of A, B, C. Maybe there was a D added in. Mm-hmm. I can't remember. But yeah, E's came later.
E's came in the 60s, right? Early 60s?
I don't...
Yeah,
I think that might have started with the 1959 with the Matterhorn.
Yeah.
The submarine and the monorail.
Okay.
That might have started the E coupon, but it might have been D. I can't quite remember for sure. I do remember the Tiki Room would not accept coupons.
It was
cash only.
It was like a dime or something?
I don't think it was that cheap. I think it might have been... I don't remember.
Yeah,
we didn't go in because you had to pay extra.
Yeah. Because at the time when it started, it was Dole had the sponsorship and they were providing the staffing for it. And I think Walt had paid for...
Or was it United Airlines?
Maybe it was that. But
I'm not sure.
But I know that Walt had paid for a lot of the Tiki Room out of his own non-studio finances. Mm-hmm. So they were trying to recoup some of the costs of doing it. And doing the creation of it for the World's Fair, because it wasn't coming out of studio money. I vaguely remember the story.
Right. I was on a studio tour as a child, well, maybe 10 or 11, and they were putting together the Tiki Room and talking about it, about how it would have actual stereo sound.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, anyway.
Oh, the technology of the time.
Right, right. Getting on to Jungle Cruise. When I started there in 1969, it was different. The park was different, but I think that all of our supervisors, every one of them, the managers, had worked on Jungle Cruise and worked his way up through the ranks. It was different.
Yeah.
And so a lot of the pranks and things were so accepted that I think management just looked the other way.
Sure.
It was expected that on an employee's last day that a group of his friends would grab him and toss him into the water.
Yeah.
And there were all kinds of silly things that went on in the jungle, and I think it was kind of allowed.
Well, I think there was a different culture in general at the time, because mm-hmm. there wasn't the fear of lawsuits that the company has to have now, and there
yes.
wasn't, you know, the need to document everything so rigidly. It was a little more of a fraternity kind of an atmosphere.
It was exactly that.
Yeah.
I remember seeing the gorillas wearing bikinis. I don't know if they even have those gorillas anymore.
And, gorillas still there.
There were and a whole bunch of the guys going out and striking poses mm-hmm. in the silly things along with the animals in the veldt.
Now, 64 was the year the veldt was added.
Right, so it was definitely there from the time I started. But say all these young men in their underwear just doing silly things or maybe in bathing suits attacking the charging hippos, like grabbed onto them with rubber knives and or dancing with the natives.
Mm-hmm.
All this stuff went on, and it made it kind of it was fun. But I remember skippers would jump from one boat to the other as they crossed by Schweitzer Falls, and then continue the tour just like.
which now would be like the first one who slips and falls and breaks something.
The humor that was acceptable back then. Was people are shocked, but say, and now, and I think some of this was in the written spiel, we're required to say it. And now, the most dangerous part of our journey, the return to civilization, the California freeways, and those crazy women drivers. And if your mother-in-law is still sitting next to you, you missed your golden opportunity, but bring her back. Our mother-in-law special leaves at midnight, halfway for half fare, no questions asked. And here on the dock, to help you out of your boat, meet the two brothers, Chimp and Pansy. We keep them around to prove that California is still famous for its fruits and nuts.
Yep. I mean, that's... I've heard versions of that from people in the past, and I just think that it was culturally such a different. I think people were a lot harder to offend,
and it was you heard that type of joke in situation comedies on TV so much that women drivers the women laughed because it was just part of it triggered
cultural
laughter,
the cultural humor base,
right? And in fact, in the 50s. Most women did not drive.
Mm-hmm.
It was the responsibility of the husband to chauffeur the family, and ladies did not drive.
Yeah.
So Walt's presence, he died in December 66. I started in 68. Uh-huh. I never met him, but I would say people, the presence was still very, very strong.
I would expect at that time it was still, like a fairy godfather kind of
very definitely
over the top of
course
park.
I heard negative stories but you would hear lots of nice things, and I remember a sweeper said that Walt had one day come up to him and asked how his boss was treating him,
mm-hmm.
and Walt said something like, "That's so important to me." He says, "The way you're treated is going to reflect upon how you treat our guests."
Yep.
And our guests don't remember how clean the place is, how beautiful it is. What they're going to remember is how they're treated as people.
Yep. Well, and it's so funny that it just takes one negative experience to wipe out all of those hundreds of good ones.
Yes.
So really caring about the guest and making sure that that one thing doesn't happen that ruins a family's day or...
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course.
No, no.
I had a friend who, as a teenage girl, had asked to join Walt Disney and sit next to him on the Small World ride. And her name is Debbie Baxter. And as they rode through, Walt said... Well, I remember he told... I wasn't there. Sure. He told her, "That's my favorite part." And he pointed to the little Ethiopian boys who were holding their tummies, rocking back and forth, laughing, along with hyenas.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they even left that part in the ride.
It's still there.
Is it?
Yeah, good. It's still there.
And another story, her brother, who's a close friend, Tony Baxter...
Yep, I was going to ask if it was...
Right, worked for Imagineering. And in his early days, he worked in the model shop.
Mm-hmm.
And he would... For props, go to the noise.
Yeah,
there.
It's actually not showing up that badly on the recordings. So.
Okay, he would pull little objects out of Walt's miniature collection that Walt Disney collected from around the world.
Yeah.
And he said it gave the nicest feeling. Mm-hmm. To he mentioned I think little tiny hurricane lamps that would be used in the Country Bear Jamboree in Florida.
Yeah. Have you had a chance to go up to the Walt Disney Family Museum up in San Francisco?
I haven't, no.
They actually have a lot of Walt's miniature collection up
beautiful,
there.
Beautiful, beautiful.
Probably 100-150 pieces, mm-hmm. like laid out. It's really amazing because you see how that influenced Storybook Canals.
Sure, sure.
You see how it influenced Journey to Inner Space.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of small and large kind of things,
yes.
that really work on.
By the way, Tony said it gave him a glow to feel that Walt seemed to know in the past what would be needed for the, parks.
I would love to chat with Tony on the podcast, just because, you know, he has some great insight into a lot of the things that were happening on Imagineering at the time. I know he's done a couple of other interviews with friends that I know, colleagues in the thing.
Yes.
I would love to get him just to chat about some of the feeling of it.
I'm sure.
Was it easy for you to get transferred over to the jungle? Was it?
For me, it seemed difficult.
Uh-huh.
They had all their policies, you know. So it, but it turned out that I was working on the Autopia, and a friend on the Jungle Cruise, Dave Pappas, wanted to trade, and they allowed it for some, mm-hmm. reason. That worked out just right for me.
Yeah.
It was good because I was very, very happy on the Jungle Cruise. Getting back to Walt, though, we were always told, or we often heard, that the Jungle Cruise was his favorite ride.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's true, but
I've heard that repeatedly from people.
And we always heard about how he insisted the cost of those elephants. He wanted it to be a full 9 minutes and, mm-hmm. travel through solar. So we used to keep stopwatches on the front of the dashboard of the Jungle Cruise boat to make sure we were at our checkpoints,
yep.
at the correct second.
People now would be amazed because when they did in 95, when they had Indiana Jones,
mm-hmm.
they cut about a minute and a half of the travel time off the river. So as people may not know as they're listening, that yes, it was used to be a significantly longer. When you say 9 minutes, some of the people there now would go, "How could it be 9 minutes?"
And, right, but it certainly was.
Yeah, it was, and it was because the river was longer. There was
and
more,
they restricted
more space to cover.
Adhere to that.
Yeah,
I did get a chance to talk with Roy's older brother. I'm sorry, Walt's older brother, Roy, and his wife about the time that Disney World was getting ready to open the Magic Kingdom there. And basically talked, because I, at the time, was considering wanting to go to live and work at Disney World. And he spoke nicely about how all their loyal and dedicated people were making this happen.
Yeah.
That's, now, I also became friends with, because I lived in Portland, Oregon for 20 years, mm-hmm. Walt's nephew. His name is Ted Beecher, and he was the son of Ruth, Walt's little sister.
Mm-hmm.
And I could talk for hours about Walt's family and stuff, yeah. but I think I'll get back to...
I got to meet Diane. Diane.
Yeah, I've never met her.
She came through when I was working at the Great Moments with Mr. Lincoln, right?
Uh-huh.
And it was her and Walt's grandson, Christopher. And we were standing at the window in front of Walt's old office. And of course, I didn't vary from the script. I was a good cast member and didn't, you know, say how great it was to meet them or anything like that. But so I sat there and I gave the spiel to someone who had actually been in that office as a child and who had actually seen that studio in that time period. And I felt so awkward telling her what all these things were when she knew about them from firsthand knowledge.
I'm sure she appreciated it.
It was one of my highlights of my 8 years there was getting to meet her. It was definitely one of the two or three things that I hold most dear at the time.
Yes. Yes. I was extremely devoted and dedicated to Disneyland, mm-hmm. enough that I think that the entire park pretty much was aware of my presence. And I think in a way I almost thought of myself as Walt Disney Jr. I wanted to come in early, leave late, you know, before my shift afterwards. I check up on everybody, make sure things were running the way I felt Walt would have wanted. And I wanted to see every little change it made. I'd snoop around the backstage and check up.
You were a fanboy before there were... Before it was...
It wasn't popular back then.
No.
In fact, I remember going, just for instance, I went to the opening of the, I think it's the Los Angeles County Museum of Contemporary Art.
Downtown?
Probably.
It's.
I was a teenager. And I remember asking the curator, do you have any Disney art? Mm-hmm. And the reaction was shock, like, Disney art? Like, almost like, that goes in the dumpster right away. People did not take it seriously.
Yeah. Well, and that was pre-Warhol. I mean, that was, you know...
Right.
That was a very different kind of contemporary art at the time. It wasn't
we
would think of, you know, with Lichtenstein. And
not at all.
No.
Especially maybe through the 50s and the 60s, the time that I was working there and started working there, mm-hmm. for the most part... Americans thought of Disneyland or the Disney movies as for kiddies.
Yep.
And it was appropriate for parents and grandchildren to take their children there, but there wasn't much interest or serious consideration for teenagers, young people, young adults.
Do you feel like that's the same for the live-action movies, or why... You know, why they started doing more live action? Do you think it was to capture a little older market?
Well, of course, you have to think of which era.
Yeah.
They're, I think that at first, their live action movies like Treasure Island, 20,000 Leagues, and Pollyanna were meant to be high. They were aiming to make something very nice. But I have heard that many of their live-action films were only made with profit in mind so that the money could be poured into the projects Walt really wanted to do. And I'm talking about very silly things like Moon Pilot or the successful ones like The Shaggy Dog.
Yeah, Cat from Outer Space.
Right, of course, that's much later.
Yeah, yeah.
But I don't think many people took those
Kurt
Russell films seriously. And
it's things that are very interesting because it's a different perspective. I mean, I think everyone knows from discussion that mm-hmm. you know it was a different time for animation,
right.
And it wasn't
there for
wasn't,
me. It
there
was,
wasn't TV animation. It was all
right.
The
in some ways
snippets.
It worked out nice for me because I used to be able to snoop around the studio, or sometimes meet the famous animators and discuss things with them, or the composers. Mm-hmm. And they were so flattered that a young an adult mm-hmm. would take their work seriously that I had some very, very nice conversations, in-depth things, because I was one of the very few that would take an interest in what they had done, what they had created.
And not to say this, you know, as gratuitous or to embarrass you, but, you know, a lot of people, when I was talking a year or 2 years ago and your name first came up, you were one of the first people who said that, you know, you were one of the... someone said you were one of Disneyland's biggest fans.
I believed in what I was doing.
Yeah, and it's such a great tribute to who you are.
I always wanted to do a good job.
Yeah.
I don't know if I was capable, but my aim was always to do the best I could do because I loved the place. I believed in what it stood for.
Well, and if it's any, you know, kind of a a positive feeling that your coworkers, you know, 30 years later, all hold you in that regard. That you know, it's Oh, absolutely. One of the first names that came out in 2011 when I started this was your name. So,
well, that's I'm surprised because so few people are left.
Yeah.
You know, but I certainly dream about being there often.
Yeah. It's kind of I joke that did you ever see the movie the Disney Cool Runnings, the Jamaican bobsled team?
I do remember. Yeah. I mean, I haven't seen it.
Yeah, no. there was a thing in there where they would do the bobsled run in their sleep. They'd be in bed sleeping, and they'd still be leaning forward and right and left the same way they would on a bobsled. I actually think that working at Disneyland, and particularly working on the Jungle Cruise, it doesn't matter how long since you were there, you still kind of, you know, it becomes part of who you are. So you're
certainly
automatically leaning to the left and right, and you're automatically thinking the way that you thought when you were there, because it does definitely permeate who you are for the rest of your life.
Yes, it does. I don't think I was ever a good spieler, but I was different. Mm-hmm. It's funny, when I first started, I got all these recordings of Winston Hibler narrating the Disney Nature films, and because I admire his such a pleasant manner, and I tried to imitate his delivery, his phrasing and mm-hmm. inflections, but after a while I realized that my boatloads or my audience was falling asleep as I would talk, so I tried something a little different. I'd say most of the other my co-workers gave a very, I don't want to say cynical, but kind of a deadpan approach, like mm-hmm. there's something you don't see every day. I do, like yeah. so many. I went almost the opposite. Mm-hmm. I decided to make it naive to the point of being ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And for me, it worked. Mm-hmm. I said such foolish things like I was an overgrown kid that really believed that all the danger was there, that mm-hmm. they... And
you were buying into it so that the people on your boat could also buy into it.
Well, for me, it was fun.
Yeah.
I had fun with it.
That's a good, that's and
I
a
think,
good delivery.
I think that most of the guests did, and I had fans. There were people who they'd be waiting there at the loading dock and say, I'm not getting in until Don's boat comes round. Mm-hmm. And people would send me pictures and letters and things. So I certainly wasn't great because I'm not glib, and I'd never had the imagination to really speak but for what I could do, I tried.
And you know, and that's something, I mean, people have asked me, and because obviously I'm invested in the, you know, but people have asked me what the secret of being a good Jungle Cruise skipper is from the delivery side. And I always tell people, don't be a comedian, be yourself. And whatever your personality is what brings the joy to the ride. You don't have to try, you just have to be however it is that you are, and that comes across as much more natural and much more convincing to just do what you're doing. So if you brought your enthusiasm, it's because you were an enthusiastic person and it came through.
Hopefully. Again, yeah. I tried. It wasn't really my natural way to be quite so cheerful, but it was fun to do it.
Yeah.
It was fun to do it that way. Getting back to, say, the public attitude towards Disneyland, when I first started around 68, you have to remember, at different times, American society was really changing a lot. Mm-hmm. With, I'll say typified by the hippies.
Yep.
And the wholesome goodness and clean-cut grooming of Disneyland was probably quite offensive to a big portion of America. Mm-hmm. They thought of it as being artificial, not appealing.
Kind of naive about it.
Well, just maybe in the way of being like a lie to society.
Sure.
I think a standby phrase might have been, tell it like it is. Things became earthy, vulgar, in society, mm-hmm. I mean.
Yeah.
And so Disneyland almost was going counter to that. Mm-hmm. Though there was a movement at the same time that started right around 1968, kind of a surprise thing, where nostalgia, suddenly became popular. Mm-hmm. And where it would have been impossible for an adult to consider, you know, no one in his right mind would wear a Mickey Mouse watch up until around 1968. Yep. And then all these things of adults acting like children mm-hmm. suddenly became fashionable. Mm-hmm. And I think in some ways that did help. There was a kind of a slump in the Jungle Cruise, I would say. And of course, it's hard to put it all in perspective.
Sure.
But they became aware that the prestige that was once attached to Jungle Cruise, mm-hmm. maybe 50s and 1960s, was slipping. I think, I'm not sure what caused it, maybe the opening up of Pirates of the Caribbean, New Orleans Square, but the tour guides didn't fall all over and fall in love with Jungle Cruisers right away like they used to. And there was an odd movement. I became a trainer, and I remember a military-minded, or who had been in the military, supervisor, deciding, we're going to fix the spirit of the Jungle Cruise by making everything strict. And so, whereas before, we used to wear summer costumes that were, I guess, maybe kind of Jamaican, loose-fitting, bright-colored, and with sandals. And each Jungle Cruiser had his individual hat with toy gorillas and bananas and all tattered and funny snakes and things on the hats. That was immediately eliminated in favor of making everything regimented mm-hmm. to create a team spirit.
Sure.
And as a trainer, I was told they mustn't even add the word "and" into the spiel. It's got to be verbatim, word for word.
Well, and that was 60s, you said?
That would have probably been maybe about 1970.
Yeah, because that was one of the things I know from kind of my history of talking to people, was there was a big influx after around the Vietnam War time, and maybe even, you know, with some of the other people who were getting out of the military mm-hmm. pre-Vietnam, who were retiring, and there were a couple of the higher-ups in the Disneyland chain who were ex-military. So they had a habit of hiring...
I remember some of those mean ones, yes.
Yeah, they
yes.
had a habit of hiring military people because, uh-huh. you know, they were used to organizing and working with large groups of people, and the corporate culture wasn't what it was today.
Well, I did see that with the Jungle Cruise.
Yeah.
And I did see it actually in other parts of the park. But there were a lot of nice things that were instituted, and I don't remember exactly when they took down that big tower where the Jungle Cruise guys could take their breaks and see when they're, you know, out in front of the ride.
Yeah, yeah.
That might have been just before I started. They had cut they changed the loading dock so it was mm-hmm. straightened out instead
sure.
of that nice big curve about this time. But they gave us our own special, instead of the one up in the tower, they're called Juba, the Jungle Upstairs Break Area,
yep.
which was that above the Adventureland Bazaar, there is a wrought iron gate, went to a stair with yep. bougainvillea. It's a kind of almost a skinny hallway mm-hmm. of a room.
Yep. It's become an electrical closet as the years
okay.
go by,
okay.
with all the circuit breakers.
But it was
panels,
meant as a spirit builder,
yeah.
and it was kind of nice. Joel Haberstadt, who later became my editor of the Disneyland Line, I think he made I'll call it a poster, but a photograph of each skipper mm-hmm. with a comic saying inscription underneath. And I remember the one for me said, "Wow, I love loading boats. I love it, love it, love it," or something like that. And he asked me to decorate this poster. I put little jungle pictures of Mickey with Mickey Mouse, wild animals in 1930s style. And Joel liked it. He said, "And now I'm editor of the Disneyland Line. Could you do a Christmas cover for..." This was the old employee newsletter that came out each week. And so I did a picture of the famous characters like Goofy, Pluto, seven characters in it, in a Christmas scene. And they said, "Well, we have bad news for you. It has to be redrawn by one of the official artists, Chuck Boyer." And he ruined it.
Mm-hmm.
But that version of the picture was reused for at least 20 years for different publications, advertising, and stuff. And it really was basically my design. So that was
it's nice.
My claim to fame, but I never got credit or paid for it.
And there we go, everyone, cutting our interview in half. Again, I know that frustrates some of you, but we have to do that for space. We will have the second half of this great interview in 2 weeks, September 16th, on any of the places where you normally download your podcasts. You can also leave us messages over at Facebook, facebook.com/junglecruise, C-R-E-W-S, or at our Podbean page, junglecruisecrews.podbean.com. We love hearing your comments, and we look forward to bringing you more great episodes just like this. Thanks, everybody.